We've been talking for some time now about the divine qualities. As I mentioned from time to time, this started out as an 8-lesson series, but this time through I've tried to enlarge on it and concentrate on some things that I mentioned in passing when I had preached this series before. So this is number 20 of what used to be an 8-lesson series, the divine qualities. I like the English Standard Version translation, where it talks about these things being qualities, whereas the King James and New King James, it says things. The English Standard Version says qualities, and I like that, especially when you consider that the subject at hand is how to become a partaker and remain a partaker of the divine nature. And the divine nature is made up of divine qualities, and we can have these divine qualities. The Word of God is so designed that it can impart to us the divine nature. We'll never be God, don't get me wrong, but we can have His character. We can have His nature where character is concerned, and that's what the series is all about. And now we're at that point where we're talking about how that we should supplement godliness with brotherly affection. And we've talked about brotherly affection. We've talked about some other related matters. But what I really want to point out in the last section is that when we're talking about supplementing godliness with brotherly affection, we're talking about demonstrating discipleship. Someone said, well, discipleship, that's learning and following, right? But that's right. That's what discipleship is. It's learning about someone with the intention of following them or patterning your life after theirs. And that's what brotherly affection is all about. I can't think of a person who had more brotherly affection than Jesus Christ. Almost every miracle that He performed, if not every miracle, and maybe every one, was an act of compassion toward some individual. He was being affectionate toward His fellow Jew. And they were brethren under that covenant that God made with Israel through Moses. Of course, we're under a different covenant, and we have spiritual brethren, and we are to extend brotherly affection to them. We talked about what it is not. It is not limiting our acts of kindness to people who are like us in physical or material ways. But it's really about extending kindness to people who share in spiritual blessings. They're like us spiritually because of the things we have in common. We looked at that the last 2 weeks. So what I'll do this week, this morning, is talk more particularly about some specific ways in which discipleship is demonstrated, and therefore specific ways that we can extend brotherly affection. This is not an exhaustive list. There are many ways to do that. I mentioned about getting up at 3 a.m. and going coon hunting. That was an act of affection toward a brother, because I had no desire to do that. But he needed me to, or thought he needed me to, and I didn't argue. I got up at 3 o'clock and I went coon hunting, running across up and down the hollers. I say it's real easy now. They got all them technical gadgets to say exactly where them dogs are, where they got that coon tree. But back then, 1978, you didn't have all that stuff, and you just had to follow the barking dogs. And there was a difference between the bark that the dog had while he was chasing the coon and the bark that he had when he had treed the coon. And you had to listen to those. And so it's very boring standing there at the truck listening to them barking dogs at 0:30 in the morning. But I'd rather have stood there than run through them hills and hollers once the barking changed. That was an act of brotherly affection, I guarantee you, toward Jim Deason. I would not have elected to do that. But one aspect or one way that the Bible talks about demonstrating discipleship and thus extending brotherly affection is speaking kindly to one another. Now, I want to apologize. I know I kind of spoiled you by putting the verses on the screen each Sunday. And that was my intention this morning, and I changed all the headings to where on each screen you can see the passage that's supposed to be there, but the passage is not there. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 11. But I want us to look briefly, and I'll try to read these fairly quickly without going excessively fast. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 31, the Apostle Paul wrote, "Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." There is no reason at all for one brother or sister to ever have malice toward another brother or sister. And though the phrase is brotherly kindness is used in that generic sense, not limited to how we treat male siblings male spiritual siblings, and how we treat all our spiritual siblings, all of God's children. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. We are to speak kindly with one another, in other words. Also in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 6, the apostle there writes, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." How do we respond to one another? You know, sometimes our brothers or our sisters get out of sort with us. And we say, "Well, that's not my fault." Well, it's not your fault how they treat you or talk to you, but it is your fault how you talk to them. And so it's not just a matter of who initiates it and whether I am making an overture or whether I'm responding to something. I'm to speak kindly without bitterness to my brothers and sisters. Speak kindly to one another. We are to return good for evil. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verses 8 and 9, the Apostle Peter had this to say, "Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil, or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing." See, whether or not we inherit a blessing may very well depend upon how we respond to evil that is done to us. We don't return evil for evil. We don't return reviling for reviling. Think of Jesus on the cross. His brethren, Jews, at the foot of the cross, reviling him, insulting him. They were the ones responsible for putting him on the cross. But how did he respond? "Father, forgive them. For they know not what they do." That's how he responded. He didn't revile in turn. He didn't speak evil of them. But he committed his soul unto God, and that's what we should do. Peter then quotes from Psalm 34, when he says, "For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." So I said, "I just can't get along with it. Don't let it be your fault that you can't get along. So you should do everything you can to seek peace and pursue it. Some people will not be at peace with you. Some brothers, some sisters won't be at peace with you. But that's what you are to seek. Seek peace and pursue it, returning good for evil rather than evil for evil. That's where that verse is supposed to be. Not only is that, speaking kindly to one another, returning good for evil, but respecting the conscience of others. Sometimes we don't do that. I use the illustration sometimes about, here's somebody that we know that they've been studying with us, they've been studying the plan of salvation. They happen to have been raised, maybe Seventh-day Adventists. I'm just using that as an illustration. And in the Seventh-day Adventist church, eating meat is frowned upon and forbidden. And so here's somebody, they've been studying, they can see, and they, you know, they worship on Saturday rather than Sunday. And they can see that water baptism is central to salvation. They can see that the Seventh-day Adventist church is not the right church, that the Sabbath is not a special day of worship for Christians, but Sunday is. And they can see the truth of the gospel. Well, you know, they come forward and they're baptized. You don't take them out for a hamburger. You got to respect their conscience. It's going to be a lot. Well, they can wrap their minds around the fact that they can eat meat if they so choose. They don't have to be vegetarians. But you don't want to put them in a position where there is no vegetables to eat, no bread to eat. You want to respect their conscience. In Romans 14, the Apostle Paul is talking about these problems that people have, problems of scruples. He's not talking about matters of opinion, because what he says is not opinion. But he is talking about scruples. In Romans 14, verse 1, receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to dispute over doubtful things. Here's somebody, they've obeyed the gospel, they've embraced the gospel, but there are some things that they have doubts about. Maybe they have doubts about eating meat. As a matter of fact, he uses that as an illustration. For one believes he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Now, the one who eats only vegetables because he's weak, he thinks he's been strong. He thinks, I'm so strong, I don't even eat meat. But it's a weakness that he feels like he can't eat meat. That's how Paul says it. He's weak, eats only vegetables. Let not him who eats meat despise him who does not eat meat. And let not him who does not eat judge him who eats. For God has received him. In verse 13, therefore let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Now in the first century, they didn't have Seventh-day Adventists. And I don't reckon they had anybody that thought they could not eat meat at all. But in Corinth, in Rome and in Corinth, some of these other places, there were people who felt like they could not eat meat that had been sacrificed on idols. Paul deals with that again in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and whether it's right or wrong depends on the mindset of the one who is eating that meat. If he's eating it as an act of worship to a false god, it's wrong. But if he's just eating meat, not considering the fact that it's been dedicated to false, then that's not wrong. And so sometimes the same act can be right or wrong depending on your point of view, your purpose for doing it, and your attitude in the thing. But here were some, they could not eat certain meats. Jewish Christians, they could not eat. They couldn't eat catfish. You know, I was 30 years old before I ever tasted catfish. Prior to that, I just couldn't get around how ugly that thing was. I just could not make myself believe that it tasted good. But I was in a position where it was either eat catfish or make somebody feel bad because they took me out to a catfish restaurant to eat. And so I ate it and I'm like, this is good. So a few years ago, I encouraged a young friend who was 20, had never eaten catfish. I said, don't wait until you're 30. And about 5 years later, he said, I want to thank you for encouraging me to eat catfish, man. I love it. And that they couldn't eat catfish because catfish were scavengers. They couldn't eat pork. Oh, I'm glad I wasn't a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Couldn't eat bacon. Couldn't eat pork chops. And again, Seventh-day Adventists, they can't eat any kind of meat. But that's the situation here. And he's saying, don't put a stumbling block. If they got trouble eating meat, fine. Let them be vegetarian. Don't put a stumbling block. Verse 21, it is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine, nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. So you don't want to encourage him overtly or non-overtly by your example to do what might very well be against his conscience. You respect the conscience of others. That's an act of brotherly affection. Also in 1 Corinthians 8, verses 9 and 13, as I mentioned a while ago, Paul deals with the eating of meat over here also, especially eating of meat sacrificed to idols. He says in verse 9 of 1 Corinthians 8, beware lest somehow this liberty of yours, free to eat meat sacrificed to idols, nothing wrong with it inherently, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. You know that there's an idol is nothing. You're not eating this meat as an act of worship toward that idol, but by eating meat in front of somebody who just can't get that false god out of his mind, to think of that as an act of worship. Well, you are a discouragement to him. In verse 13, he says, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat, and I never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. It might be better to give it up. You know the point? Yeah, it might be. I don't have to eat it to go to heaven. If it became a stumbling block, yeah, I ought to give it up. That'd be hard. But, you know, brotherly kindness demands that, respecting the conscience of others. That's what those verses should have been. Not only that, but we should be preferring one another. Now, when we're talking about preferring one another, we're not talking about preferring one another above God or Jesus Christ. We're talking about preferring one another against ourselves. We're talking about matters of judgment here. In Romans chapter 12, for example, and verse 10, the apostle says, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another. And so there's a specific instance or example of being kindly affectionate to one another, which is what we're talking about. Giving in honor, giving preference to one another. When I moved here in 1999, we already had carpets and padded pews, and I was glad. I don't know, you know, what kind of discussion went on at the time, whether that was from the very time that the building was constructed or whether there was some time passed. But a lot of times, churches will get into a fight over whether or not to carpet the building, whether or not to pad the pews. And once they agreed, then the color of the carpet, the color of the pew pad. You know, these become matters of dispute. That ought not to be. If you want chartreuse bench covers, that's fine with me. I think that's kind of a green, I don't know, or fuchsia, you know, if you like fuchsia. Some things are neither here nor there, is my point. It doesn't matter or shouldn't matter. But if it does matter to somebody, and it doesn't really matter in the long run, we'll give in to their preference. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul illustrates this by talking about the attitude of Jesus. Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or deceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than themselves. In other words, unless it, again, If it's a matter of truth, then certainly truth should never be compromised. Truth should never be sacrificed. But if not, if the truth is not at stake, if there's authority for it, then it ought not to be a matter of controversy. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. I have to be concerned with your feelings and your thoughts and your opinions and your judgment, instead of thinking, I've got to have my way. There are some people like that. My way or the highway. Well, it ought to be our attitude that God's way or the highway, but not my way or the highway. My way is no higher than your way, and not nearly as high as God's way. But God's way is higher than any man's way, and we should always give in to the way God says to do something if he tells us how to do it. But if something is a matter of judgment, then we give in to one another. Whoever feels strongest about it, fine. Let them have it their way if it doesn't matter. Also, assisting one another when in need. I hope I'm not embarrassing Ronnie and Jenny, but in December of 2012, I had to have surgery, and they took me into their home, and I convalesced in their home. You know, I never got a bill for that. I don't think it was an oversight. No, Ronnie doesn't overlook money. That was not an oversight. They had no intention of billing me for providing a place for me to convalesce from my surgery. That's an act of love, brotherly kindness. And I don't know how many times they have taken me down to for a procedure that I could not drive myself home from. Put me down there, waited patiently for the procedure to end, and drove me home or back to there. I was on occasion that I spent the night beforehand, and they've gotten up and fixed me whatever I could legitimately eat, if I could eat anything beforehand, and took me back to their house afterward. So they didn't trust me not to drive, I guess. That wasn't the case. But, and I'm not saying nobody else has done things for me, but I said these are the things that stick in my mind. These are large, and they hadn't even known me for a year. They probably knew me for a year longer, but they hadn't known me because they had only started worshiping here in 2002. If I said 2012 all ago, it was 2002. But that's what the Apostle Paul teaches in Romans, and the Bible teaches in Romans chapter 12 and verse 13. And I know I say the Apostle Paul says this, somebody says, well, you ought to say the Bible says this. Well, it's the same thing. When the Apostle Paul wrote it as an inspired apostle of Jesus Christ, it was God writing it. But in Romans chapter 12, verse 13, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. We all ought to be given to hospitality and to do what we can for anybody, but especially for the brethren. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. In verse 10, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all, especially those from the household of faith. We have a humanitarian responsibility to anybody and everybody. But we have a more peculiar responsibility to brothers and sisters in Christ. And I want to say that while I'm on that point, when congregations extend benevolence, or as likely to extend congregational benevolence to a non-saint as a saint, they are not making that distinction. Now, we have responsibilities to people whether they are saints or not, but we have a more important responsibility and a special responsibility to those who are the household of faith. And those are the only ones the church collectively can help out of the scriptures. You and I individually can and should help people who are not saints. But if it's a matter of I can help this saint or I can help this non-saint, I should give preference to the saint. Although it might be the case that the church is in a situation they can help the saint, leaving me free to help the non-saint. Sometimes it works out that way. But it doesn't always. But assisting one another when in need is a manifestation of brotherly kindness and a demonstration of discipleship, because Jesus certainly was one who did that. I apologize for not removing the animation on all these as we went through. I thought I was through last night, and I was not. Sharing one another's grief. And Paul says this in Romans chapter 12 and verse 15, just two verses down from the one we read a moment ago. Rejoice with them that rejoice, and in sorrow weep with those who weep. Oftentimes we hear about, I say we, I don't mean we personally, but I mean we in general. You hear about somebody being having some special honor and you're jealous, envious, you know, it should have been me. That's not right. That's not the way we ought to be. We should rejoice with those who rejoice. By the way, my grandson won the golf tournament up there in Cumming, Georgia a couple of weeks ago, and I rejoiced with him. And then he came down here and played in one, and he finished fourth. But I rejoiced in that. And I know he was not as joyful in that one as he was in the previous one. But things like that we ought to be concerned about, and we ought to encourage and, you know, and be and share in that joy with them, and not be envious or jealous of something that some honor that somebody else has received. In 1 Corinthians 12, verses 24 through 26, but our presentable parts have no need that God composed the body, having given greater honor to that part which lacks it, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now what Paul is doing there, he's talking about the local body, the church, as if it were a physical body. He's using the physical body as an illustration. He talked earlier about the ear is not invaluable. It's not of no value just because it can't smell. It can't perform the function that the nose is designed to perform. And the eye can't hear. That doesn't mean it's useless or worthless. We need the eye. We need the ear. We need all the parts of the physical body that we have. Sometimes people are deprived of one part. They're blinded. They're deaf. They're mute. They're lame. They've had parts amputated. And that's sad. But he's using the body as it was designed by God. It was designed to function as a unity, not as separate body parts. I remember one day I lit a match, and I made a mistake. Don't ever let light a match toward you, if you don't already know that. Back it away from me. I lit a match toward me, and the head of that match flew off and would have hit me in the eyeball, but my eyelash had saved my eyeball. And before I even knew that that match was coming, my eyelashes had caught it. That's the way reflexes are. That's the way the body was set up. And use this, you hurt somewhere, you put some other part of the body down there to try to alleviate the pain. Your body works together. That's the way the local church should be. In particular, he's talking here about the spiritual gifts, how that people who might not have been as presentable in some ways as others, they were given the better gift. They call attention to them for a change, but for spiritual reason. The gift of prophecy and the gift of tongues, they were given in accordance with what the Holy Spirit felt like they needed. And so some of them needed something and some of them didn't. And so he goes on to say, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? Of course not. All these gifts weren't given to all people. The apostles had them all. It says, but earnestly desire the best gift, and yet I show you a more excellent way. And that more excellent way was the way of love. So spiritual gifts were for the first century. But love would outlast those. Matter of fact, in chapter 13, he talks about how the faith, hope, and charity, or love, was to outlive those spiritual gifts, and they did. Then he goes on to say, and the greatest of these is love, because love will outlast faith and hope. Because one day our faith will become sight, and our hope will become possession. But they'll never get anything to replace love. Remember, when we get to heaven, our love for God and one another will be intensified. And we'll have a spiritual body rather than this natural body that will greatly facilitate that relationship that we have together in God and in Jesus Christ. So sharing one another's griefs and enjoying one another's joys, etc., is a part of demonstrating discipleship or brotherly affection. Finally, restoring the erring in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. We ought to never be unconcerned about those who err. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, this is Galatians 6 and 1, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. You have to be careful how you deal with situations like that, but they need to be dealt with. If a person is and overtaken in a trespass, there's a danger there. The longer he is in that trespass, the more difficult it is for him to give it up, to come out of it, to cease it. And we have a responsibility to that individual. In James chapter 5, verses 19 and 20, the last two verses in the book of James, brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, then let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. So covering sin is not a matter of sweeping them under the rug. It's dealing with and encouraging people to forsake those sins. Turning brethren from the error. See, it's not the case that once you're saved, you're always saved. You've got to be faithful unto death, Revelation 2, verse 10. And we have a responsibility in that to help one another to be faithful unto death. So if we see one another in sin, we have a responsibility and obligation to do that because of our brotherly affection that we have, and the fact that we are disciples and are to be demonstrating that. And I think there's just one more point here. Following the golden rule. And I say that kind of sums it all up. It's always good to have some specific examples. But in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, Jesus says, therefore, whatsoever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. There were at least two times where Jesus summed up the religion, that stage of it that God had given to the Jews. In one place he says, love you, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the two things he sums it up as. Here, as far as our relationship with one another is concerned, and manifestation of that love that we are to have, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. It's not do unto others as they have done to you, but or do unto others before they could do unto you, but do unto others as you would have them do you. How do you want to be treated? Don't you want people to speak kindly to you? Don't you want people to return good for any evil you might have done? Don't you want people to respect your conscience, prefer your preferences, and to assist you when you're in need, and share in your grief, and to restore you when you're erring? Then those are the things we ought to do for other people, especially saints. You need to make your heart right with God. That is, if you have not become a saint. And this is a strong argument to me that you don't read about the Catholic Church in the New Testament. In the Catholic Church, a person must choose between marriage and priesthood. So not all Catholics are priests. And no Catholics are saints until long after they're dead, when they've been canonized. In order to be canonized, one miracle has to be attributed to you while you're alive. Well, in the first century, all Christians were priests and all Christians were saints. You didn't have to choose between priesthood and marriage. You didn't have to wait until you were canonized to be a saint. All Christians are priests. All Christians are saints. So what we have in